Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In the wake of the international outcry over the disappearance and presumed murder of Saudi dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi, new attention is being directed towards the new muscular foreign policy of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Continuing competition between the Saudis and Iran for dominance in the region, intervention in the civil war in Yemen, and now its alleged involvement in extraterritorial illegal actions. Against that backdrop, my guest today spoke last evening to the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations on the explosive mix of religion and politics in the Middle East. Dr. Charles Kimball is a presidential professor and chair of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He previously served that same role at Wake Forest University, and from 1983 to 1990, he was the director of the Middle East Office at the National Council of Churches. He's the author of five books, including When Religion Becomes Evil, Five Warning Signs, and his most recent book is When Religion Becomes Lethal, The Explosive Mix of Politics and Religion in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Again, he was the guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Charles Kimball, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. Good to be here.
You'll be speaking on the mix of religion and politics in the Middle East. I think when Americans think about religion and politics, especially in the Middle East, we tend to think of one dynamic, and that's what it has to do with religious extremism. Is that too narrow a perspective in your view?
Yeah, it is way too narrow. It's understandable in a way because the media, particularly television media, will tend to gravitate towards what is most dramatic and sensational. And so people in ISIS or an extremist group doing something horrific, executing someone, cutting off their head or whatever, the media can't get there fast enough. It's important to realize that there are probably 1.6, 1.7 billion Muslims in the world, the overwhelming majority of whom are doing exactly what everybody else is doing. They're trying to, you know, get ready for grandma's birthday party tomorrow night, and who's going to fix the flat tire and get the kids to school and put food on the table. They're living normal lives, but that doesn't draw attention. A good example is 9/11, where arguably the events of 9/11 did a lot to change the world. Well, it was 19 people and maybe a couple hundred people behind them, which is, I mean, even nobody knows how many violent extremists there are. There may be 100,000 or 200,000. But that's just a tiny fraction of the Muslims in the world. And so, and when you look at the behavior of extremists from a group like ISIS, number one on the list for who is harmed by these extremists are other Muslims.
People who don't measure up to that extremist view.
Exactly. Well, it doesn't mean it's not dangerous. I want to underscore that. I mean, small numbers of people can wreak havoc, as we know. But it's no more representative, I would say, than if you look at the KKK, or you look at some Irish Republican extremist, you know, in the conflict before we saw in Great Britain and Ireland, or people from Westboro Baptist Church. You know, there are all kinds of extremists that we see, and most Christians would not say, well, that's not representative of what I know of Christianity, but it's an extreme, but we recognize it's part of the picture, but not representative. That's the way I think the vast majority of Muslims, you know, view these extremists, although I would also hasten to add that there are a lot of Muslims, a much larger percentage of people, who are living in circumstances where they feel angry and frustrated and repressed. And so that's where the appeal from some of the extremists comes from, is that the only thing anybody understands is when you hit them with the Achilles in the Achilles heel. And so that's the danger of more people being drawn toward that as somehow a solution to the problems that they're facing.
And, you know, I think a lot of times we focus on Islamic extremism to the detriment of other extremists. You know, every religion has its extremists. There's Jewish extremists that are doing acts of violence in the West Bank. Right. There are Christian extremists here in this country and elsewhere. There are Hindu extremists in the conflict between Pakistan and India. There are extremists for every religion.
There are Buddhist extremists oppressing Muslims in Myanmar.
Right, exactly.
These days as well. So actually my previous book, When Religion Becomes Evil, is looking at that very issue of, you know, this common feature across different religious traditions. What's going on? What accounts for behavior in where people claim allegiance or, you know, follow a particular religious tradition? Let me put it this way. If you ask most Christians, they would readily say, well, Jesus taught a gospel of love. Turn the other cheek, You know, if someone strikes you on one cheek, you turn the other cheek. Go the extra mile. You know, pray for your enemies. That's not always been lived out very well in Christian history, as a rabbi friend once put it to me rather bluntly. He said, you know, 2,000 years of Christian love is about all we Jews can bear. When you look at the history of Christian anti-Semitism, it certainly doesn't feel like a gospel of love. True. If you happen to have been Jewish.
And, of course, every religion also preaches that same
right. Islam is a religion
gospel
of, peace,
of love, a religion right. of peace. And yet,
the behavior always, doesn't always match,
right.
to be sure.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the issues going on in the Middle East today. You see a lot of state-to-state violence, state-sponsored violence, proxy violence. And a lot of this, some analysts say it's very much religious-oriented. Other analysts will say it's less religious-oriented and more state security, state strategic interests coming to the fore. What is your view on a lot of things like, you know, Yemen?
Yeah, I think it's all of the above. Mm-hmm. And clearly religion plays a role. It always is in the mix somehow. Let me take you back a little bit, say, to 1990 when Saddam Hussein, who was a secular thug of the First Order, nobody mistook him for being a religious leader. But after he invaded Kuwait and you know, the world reaction was so negative, he started calling for the liberation of Jerusalem. He had Allahu Akbar sewn onto the secular Iraqi flag. He did anything he could to pull at the religious heartstrings of people. And so one of the things that's always in the mix is that political leaders are certainly willing and able to use religion for political purposes. Now, that's not something that would ever happen in our country, of course, but it does happen around the rest of the world. I say that a bit tongue-in-cheek,
yes.
obviously. So it's always a part of the mix, but I think the larger issues tend first and foremost to be, particularly when we look at situations today with Saudi Arabia, Iran, Syria, and so forth, have much more to do with who's the big guy on the block, what are the economic interests, who's going to get what oil flowing where. So it has more to do, I think, with strategic and economic and political power. And then religion gets woven into the mix, at least in terms of state-to-state actors. You do have some non-state actors where religion plays a much more prominent role, and some of them are very visible
in
their
Syria.
Extremism,
yeah,
like in Syria,
ISIS,
and obviously
yeah.
Al-Qaeda as well.
Mm-hmm. But when we're looking at state-to-state, I think a lot of people look at this competition in many ways that you're talking about between Saudi Arabia and Iran through the prism of sects of Islam, Shia versus Sunni. Is that a too simplistic a view in your
view? It's too simplistic, but it's real. I think in mm-hmm. that case, it is actually, there is a lot of animosity, particularly in the case of Saudi Arabia. This is the Saudis practice the most conservative form of Sunni Islam. Without getting too much into the weeds, there are four major Sunni schools of Islamic law that developed fairly early on and are all recognized. The most conservative of those is the Hanbali school, which is what Wahhabi Islam comes out of. And so and you see that in Afghanistan as well and other places. The Saudis have exported that over the last half century, particularly with oil wealth and building mosques and training people. So they've exported a very conservative, and it's a very negative approach to the Shiites. The Shiites are, you know, heretical. They also have been very hostile towards the mystics of Islam, the Sufis. So there is that element that runs pretty deep in the Iran and Saudi relationship. But it's not, in all cases, that's not the big deal. Some people, as you say, will say, oh, this is all about the Sunnis and the Shiites. Well, not really. But it is much more intensified. If you think about it this way, and most people don't sort of take this step back, I think, the Sunnis represent maybe 85%, probably roughly, of Muslims around the world. The Shiites, 12, 13, 15% maybe. But in the arc between Pakistan and Lebanon, which includes Iran, Iraq, Syria, and into Lebanon, the Shiites make up probably closer to 45% of the population. So there's a much more volatile sort of mix. And what you really have to do, again, without going into the weeds too much, but just to get the picture, is you really have to get into the particulars of a particular place and its history and colonial heritage and tribal dimensions. You can't simply talk about Lebanon like you talk about Pakistan. It's not the same thing. But into that swirl, there are some Sunni Shia dynamics and what happens in many places, is, except in Iran, where the Shia are 90% plus of the population, you often find historically a lot of economic disparity, and the Shia were not in power in places like Lebanon or Iraq, and now are exercising more power. And so there's a lot of economic repression that's being played out now. We're feeling our oats. Remember, for example, well, after the war in Iraq began in 2003, and we all remember, you know, the effort to establish a new constitution and the people running out with purple thumbs that they had voted and so forth. Well, the Shiites in Iraq were saying, hey, voting's a great idea. We have the numbers.
Yes.
And so, you know, they've had the prime ministership. And yet they were never in control or in power during Saddam's reign.
Yeah, Iraq was a minority-run
right,
government
exactly.
by the Baathists.
And so you can see, you know, in that case, they were said, oh, no, we think democracy is a really good idea, at least initially here, too, because we know we have the numbers, even though we've been economically cut out of the picture.
The unrest and violence after the invasion was led by Sunnis who were disaffected by the fact that they were no longer dominant.
Right. There was a lot of and there was a lot of violence coming from the Shiite side, too. There
True.
Was a lot of payback going
right.
on that got unleashed after Saddam was not there to be the strong man, sort of keeping a lid on things. And there were other dynamics, obviously, right, with the Kurds in the north, who were mostly Sunni, but also felt the you know sting of oppression in a very big way under Saddam.
Again, it goes back to borders after World War I, which
right.
were not made in that land, but made
with colonial powers' interests at heart.
Diplomats in Western Europe.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
We're losing power, but how can we maintain as much as we can control and access to resources, trade, and so forth? And so, yeah, there's an artificiality about some of the borders in the nation states that is still being played out.
My guest today is Dr. Charles Kimball. He's a presidential professor and chair of religious studies at the University of Oklahoma. He's author of two big books on religion, When Religion Becomes Evil, and then When Religion Becomes Lethal. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations, speaking on the explosive mix of religion and politics in the Middle East, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, let me talk about another divide that is being talked about when it comes state to state, and that is Sunni versus Sunni. Mm-hmm. And this is sort of playing out in the news as we speak with, you know, you have the Turkish regime, right. Erdogan, who has had no problem jailing all sorts of of journalists and exiling journalists and putting them in prison. And yet they're leading the charge against the disappearance and apparent death of Jamal Khashoggi, this dissident Saudi journalist. What do you make of that? Because I've read some interesting things talking about how this is, it goes to this divide, and it becomes more than just religion. It's also about how the state views itself, whether it's going to be a complete autocratic monarchy, as in the case of Saudi Arabia, or I don't want to say a democracy, but sort of a, quote, semi-democratic country within recognized parties that can compete.
Yeah, I think this is where it does get really, really complex, and one has to dive in deeper. These are predominantly Sunni countries, obviously, but if you look at the history of Turkey in the 20th century, it became much more of a secular state.
It was a colonial master for Saudi Arabia,
right? And it was also, you know, they began to change things pretty dramatically under Ataturk. Looked to the West; it's obviously a NATO ally now. And so forth. And it wasn't very long ago, really just a decade ago, many people were talking about Turkey as the model for Islam in the future. Look at the democracy and they vote and they're a NATO, Western-aligned ally. They're not hostile to the United States and so forth. But in recent years with the what is still, I think, fairly ambiguous, the attempted overthrow and how legitimate or how much that was staged, has led to a phenomenal crackdown in Turkey where all kinds of judges and journalists have been jailed. There are a lot of people in the United States who can't go back to Turkey now. And so it's a very repressive regime. And initially, Erdogan was a religiously oriented leader, but looked like somebody, at least a lot of people thought, he was going to be a pretty open one. That's far from the case now. But they are Sunni Muslims. I think this has a lot more to do with with power and who's the big boy on the block. And so it's not a Sunni versus Sunni dynamic. Saudi Arabia is a powerful player, and a lot of that comes simply from the resources. Historically, of course, they also they're the protector of the two great mosques and cities of Mecca and Medina, and so that's part of their guardianship or their legacy. But there's not a lot of love towards the Saudis in many other parts of the Sunni world.
I was reading a column by Shlomo Ben-Ami, who was a former Labor Party Israeli foreign minister when the last Labor government, the Barak administration. And he was writing what we're seeing in the Middle East today is less religion's influence on Middle East politics than complete strategic and securities concerns. He looked at examples like Sunni nations like Oman and Qatar, who feel threatened by Saudi Arabia, especially the way they're acting in Yemen, making alliances with Shia Iran. You look at a Shia-led Iraq rejecting Iranian influence and trying to get Iranian influence out of Iraq. Is there anything to that idea that maybe religion is playing less a role than the idea of a Middle Eastern great game among the players themselves on a sort of a geopolitical scale?
Yeah, again, I would say yes and no, boldly assert yes and no to that. That I think in many ways you can't look at this through the lens only of religion, and yet religion is a very powerful and pervasive force. We see it in our own country as well, that people are not voting because of religion, but it does become a very, very strong motivating factor, as we could talk about that. Here in the U.S., and I mean, you can't imagine anybody running for president who says, well, let's just, this whole God language has just got to go. You know, we can't, that's too anachronistic. Let's get real. I mean, Bill Maher is not going to be running for president. It wouldn't fly. But, having said that, religion is still a very powerful force. And let me put it this way. If you were to take, 50 Muslims from one of the Muslim majority countries around the world, there are 55 plus Muslim majority countries. And let's take they're the average person. They're the average person in Pakistan or Kuwait or Morocco, pick your country, and say and ask this question: do you think that Islam can provide a basis for the organization of your nation state in the 21st century? I'm convinced that a large majority of those people would say yes. If you went one step further and passed out sheets of paper and say, okay, well, sketch out what would that look like? What kind of government would that, what form would it take? And how would that work? And how would people be involved in representative government or participatory government? You'd find about 55 different answers coming back at you. So there is this hope that's out there, and it's rooted in a long history of a brilliant Islamic civilization that lasted hundreds and hundreds of years. So people will say, but Islam once did lead the world. It can work. We don't like the whole capitalist system and the communist system, and we've experimented with all these things. So we think Islam can provide a way, but exactly what that is and how that works is all over the map. So you see various experiments, and if you just take two contemporary examples, Pakistan was founded to be an Islamic state, explicitly, much to the chagrin of Gandhi, who didn't want to see it broken off. And Pakistan's been a mess since 60 years plus. I don't know anybody who would line up to take a class from the Pakistanis on how to organize an Islamic state, and yet that's what they explicitly have tried to be. It's not easy. Iran, after the revolution, became the Islamic Republic of Iran. Well, what's a republic? It's a Western parliamentary democracy. So they elect presidents. They've got a parliament. They've got cabinet members. Now, it's not a pure democracy, as we know, with the Ayatollah kind of sitting on top of the pile and other power players in the mix. But much of what they adapted had nothing to do with 7th century Arabia and a lot to do with what might work in the 20th and 21st century. So what we actually see, and I think what we're going to continue to see, are different efforts to kind of experiment. Think back to Iraq again, and that constitutional process and how difficult that was. Suddenly there were women jumping up saying, wait a minute, we had it better under Saddam than under these Shiite leaders. Well, that kind of got swept under the rug because we were more interested in smiling faces and purple thumbs. But it was an illustration of how difficult this is to take what is a hoped for future and translate that into some kind of working government in the world of nation states, which is where we are today.
Is it possible that one of the reasons those 50 theoretical Muslims would say that Islam can form a basis is because in many of these countries that have been autocratic, no free and fair elections, right, and not even restricted elections like some countries have, the Islamist parties represent the hope for a democratic society, at least something that's going to take their views into account.
And I would say that's true. And there are actually a number of Islamist parties and groups about which we hear almost nothing. What you actually have, you might have 10 different factions who are arguing different nuanced approaches to how Islam can provide a basis. But if you have one or two extremist elements who are saying essentially, well, that's well and good, but if you disagree with me, I'll kill you, it's awfully hard to have a civilized discussion about, you know, what the future is going to be. And the only thing we tend to see are those extremist elements. There are a lot of Muslims, very thoughtful, looking for ways that can move them forward. But no matter what, we're in for a very rough, probably 15 or 20 years ahead as some of these efforts play out. And then you have all the regional dynamics that you were talking about before. You have superpower dynamics imposed on that. And so it gets very messy very quickly.
Well, let's shift our focus to the United States, where we're not immune to religion playing a major role, especially in this particular government. Large proportion of the Christian evangelical community have wholeheartedly supported the Trump administration to a degree I don't think we've ever seen in American politics. Even in the moral majority days of Ronald Reagan's administration, there was support but skepticism. Right. Almost like those leaders expected to be sold out, you know, on their policy goals. But it seems like it's very much clear-cut support for one party and one administration. I don't think I can remember that in recent memory, where a block of Christians or any religious party or any religious group have been so wholeheartedly behind one candidate and
ideas.
Yeah,
I have to say, as I've been an ordained Baptist minister for 45 years. I come out of the evangelical tradition, and I have to say it's just staggering to me to see this unequivocal support, particularly, and even when you ask people, you know, why, when you have somebody who seems to be actually the embodiment of the seven deadly sins in the New Testament, how do you justify that? You know, this is all the things that that's supposedly the religious right has stood for and been willing to take anybody down for are overlooked because of a Supreme Court nominee. Is that really it? Then, you know, you can get off the moral high ground then, if that's the case, and say this is just hard-knuckle politics, that we want X, Y, and Z, and we don't care about any of the things we say for the last 30 years we cared a lot about. So it's, to me, it's a very bizarre and counterintuitive position, which I think there'll be a day of reckoning for this, and the kind of moral high ground that the religious right has claimed. And I was in the middle of a lot of that. I was on opposite Jerry Falwell on a number of occasions on national TV and national radio, taking different views on a variety of things. And yet, you know, there was room for disagreement among evangelicals. Now it seems, you know, almost to be what we see in the sort of hostility and the tribalism that characterizes sort of battles between the two parties. You're right. I think pretty much the evangelical right has just simply said this group is right and we're with them, and that's the way it is. But that's political. That is not the moral high ground that they had claimed all along.
Let's talk about one issue where that plays out, and that is the moving of the American embassy to Jerusalem.
Right.
Every Middle East specialist says this diminishes the prospects for long-term peace in the region. It removes the last vestige of the U.S. being a neutral partner, a party between Israelis and Palestinians. It's difficult to conclude anything, but it was moved because evangelicals wanted it moved.
And it was something that President Trump could point to as, I promised I'd do it and I did it. Other presidents have promised it, but nobody did it. And that is partly because, and I've been very much involved in that issue for many decades, because when presidents got into position, into the presidency, they realized that the longer-term goal was peace and stability in the Middle East, and this was an incredibly disruptive practice. I actually gave congressional testimony for 3 hours before God, Congress, and C-SPAN back in 1984. This was a really hot issue, and I was representing the National Council of Churches at the time. The National Council of Churches and the U.S. Catholic Conference of Bishops opposed the embassy move, as did the Reagan administration, but all kinds of other groups, including Jerry Falwell, who was on that same panel, were for it. And our argument was, as you've implied, continued to be the argument, this is the most difficult, the most contentious issue. Even Sadat wouldn't touch it in the Camp David peace process, and they put it, if you read the accords, it's at the very end saying this has to be negotiated as the last thing.
Same way in the Oslo Accords.
Right. And so this is, if you really hope for peace in the Middle East, then this is not the thing to do. This is something that well, as you say, I think it takes off the last of the fig leaf that somehow the U.S. is interested in being an honest broker. But there are many other indications. It's not terribly surprising when you have a U.S. ambassador who supports the settlement process, something that the U.S. government, Democrat and Republican, for, you know, since 1967 have opposed, and it's contrary to international law as well. And now we have a government that says it's okay. Nobody, I think, who's had anything to do with the Middle East, and I've been, you know, working on these issues for decades, doubts that Israel's security is going to be ever negotiated away, or that Jerusalem, whatever the settlement is going to be a danger to Israel's future security. They're going to lock that down in whatever way they need to. And so this is more of a symbolic move. If there is peace between Israel and the Palestinians, there is little doubt that the U.S. and other embassies would move to Jerusalem. But it needs to be done, or needed to be done, in a way that provided a measure of face-saving and dignity for the Palestinians and for the Muslims around the world to say we, too, have a deep interest in and appreciation for Jerusalem, something that would affirm really what the U.N. was trying to do back in 48 with Jerusalem as a kind of international city that would be accessible to Jews, Christians, and Muslims, all of whom revere that holy place.
Dr. Charles Kimball, thanks very much for your time.
Rich, great to be with you.
Dr. Charles Kimball is a presidential professor and chair of religious studies at the University of Oklahoma. He's the author of 5 books, including When Religion Becomes Evil and his most recent book, When Religion Becomes Lethal. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night, speaking on the explosive mix of religion and politics in the Middle East. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.